Judiciary Committee come to order. We'll have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It's about 1:38 on the afternoon of Wednesday, February 15th, 2012. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Coghill is here, myself, Senator French, and Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski. Two members excused, Senator McGuire and Senator Pascman, both excused. So we are here on two bills, one dealing with trusts, the other a criminal bill. We will start with the trust bill, and that is SB 165. And what we'll do is we have three amendments before the committee today. I anticipate debating them, likely to adopt them, but we'll see what the committee thinks, and then letting the bill sit for at least one more hearing while we think about the changes we've made. It's a big piece of legislation. But let's go ahead and turn to that bill now, SB 165. And I think we have Mr. Schaftel on the line. Are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Fantastic. And you have the amendments styled D1, D2, and D3?
Yes, I do.
Let's turn first to Amendment D1. It's amendment by me. I will offer it and then object. I'll move the amendment and object to it. D1 is now before the committee. Mr. Schaftel, would you please explain what the amendment does?
Mr. Chairman, this amendment is not from our group, but as I understand it from your legislative assistant, Cindy Smith, this amendment was requested by an association of insurance companies, a representative for an association of insurance companies, and it was designed to, as I understand it, it was designed to restrict the insurance provision which we are, which you have in your bill, to prevent what was called stranger-owned life insurance.
And what is stranger-owned life insurance?
I'm not an expert in this area, but I can tell you what I know. There is this industry that's developed where people were investing in life insurance policies on people who they were not related to. And the insurance companies don't like that. They don't like it because most insurance policies lapse, and therefore the insurance companies don't have to pay the proceeds. So they didn't like it when people were coming in and making investments. In other words, they were buying insurance that either didn't exist to begin with or already existed and somebody else was going to let lapse. They would go in and say, well, let me just buy that policy from you. And this amendment, as I understand it, is intended to restrict or prevent that from occurring. Now, since we didn't draft it or request it, that's about as far as I can go, but I can tell you that our group that worked on the insurable interest provision that you have in front of you, we don't have any objection to this amendment. It's not a controversy as far as we're concerned. Our main concern with this insurable interest statute modification is just to make sure that a trustee who buys insurance for a trust, where let's say you set up a trust and you want that trust to own a life insurance policy that will benefit your family, your spouse, your children, your grandchildren, we want to make sure that that trustee has an insurable interest. And that was cast in doubt about 5 years ago by a case that was rendered back east. And so the Uniform Trust Code has recommended that modifications be made in statutes in order to make it clear that the trustee would have an insurable interest. That's what we're interested in. That's what the provision before you does. This modification doesn't affect that, doesn't hurt that, and so we're fine with it. I don't know if the representative from the insurance industry is on the line and available to testify as well on this or not. I'm not sure.
Mr. Schaftel, I'll let you and the other members of the committee know that I have an email here from Brenda Nation, who represents the American Council of Life Insurance, life insurers. They represent more than 300 legal reserve life insurers operating in the United States. They have urged this language on us for many of the reasons that you set out, the definition in the amendment is more narrow than the one that's in the bill right now, that the trade group supports keeping this narrow for the reasons you've stated. Any committee discussion of the amendment? Senator Coghill.
I'm going to try to state it in my understanding, which is going to be non-trustee nor lawyer language, but it seems to me what we're doing is we're saying a settlor under the definition given in the book means almost a wide range of contractual relationships. This one is just a trustee that has a specific agent requirement. Help me if I'm wrong.
I think that's a good common sense reading of the amendment. Mr. Chaptal, is there anything incorrect about what Senator Coghill said?
I think it's just another way of describing what we've been talking about.
Further committee discussion. Senator Wilkowski.
Would this have any impact on in divorce cases or in exes in divorces?
Mr. Chaptal, do you know?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, what we have experienced when you have a divorce, this bill does not affect that. That's a direct answer to your question, but to give you a little bit of background, life insurance trusts are very widely used. I mean, all across the country, and if they've been used, I mean, throughout my practice, which has been over 30 years in this field, they're a very common instrument to hold life insurance either for asset protection purposes or for management for beneficiaries or to make sure that the life insurance proceeds are not taxed under the federal estate tax. So this is a very widely used technique, and it only was in 2005 that because of this one case that came out of a federal district court that people became concerned that state statutes were not written clearly enough to make it clear that a trustee would have the ability to buy and hold a life insurance policy on the life of the settlor for the benefit of the settlor's family. And so that's why this amendment is being requested. What happens in a divorce, if husband and wife go ahead and have a policy that is in a life insurance trust, often that ends up being part of the property division that the court considers. But again, this depends. I mean, there's a wide variability as to what the parties are going to negotiate and what they're going to argue over. Depending on the kind of policy, if it's a joint lives policy and both husband and wife created the trust, then if one of the parties is unhappy with that trust in view of the divorce and where those proceeds will go, then often that trust will be terminated and the policy can even be split up. But there's just a wide number of things that can happen in a divorce setting.
Would an ex still be considered family?
Oh, I see what you're asking, and that's a good question. I mean, it's a very relevant question. And yes, the answer is yes.
Further questions? Further committee discussion of amendment number one. With that, I'm going to withdraw my objection, see if there's further objection. Hearing and seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. Turns us to amendment number D2, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to offer D2 and object to it and turn to Mr. Shaftel.
Chairman and members of the committee, this amendment was the result of your last discussion and an issue brought up by Senator McGuire, where basically she said, I think I'm quoting her correctly, she was in favor of this portion of the bill, but she wanted to make sure that the way it was drafted and being presented did not limit or restrict any of the time provisions that allow funds in a uniform transfer to minors account to stay in that account, which was a very good point. And so we went back and took a look at the way we had suggested that this amendment be drafted and decided that her point was excellent and that we ought to leave the section, and that was 195, where we had inserted this language. We ought to leave it alone because that section dealt with the time limits that were set up initially when the account was set up. We ought to leave that one alone, and we ought to add a new section, and that is what this amendment does, and that's section 197. So that's a brand new section that deals with extending the time once it's already been set up. Remember, 195 sets the time when you set it up, and Mr. Chairman, you asked us to provide you with those ages, and we've provided a memo. I don't know if you have it in front of you, and
we
the
do.
Other senators have it in front of you.
We do have it.
So we have set out, there really are five different ways that these accounts can be set up, by gift, by exercise of a power of appointment, in a will or a trust where there's been authority for that, in a will or a trust that did not authorize this kind of a transfer, and by somebody who owes an obligation to the minor. And so we set out the ages there, and those have not, because of this amendment, those have all been left untouched, which was what Senator McGuire, the issue she raised, and which is what she desired, and makes a lot of sense. And there, so by taking out the changes that were being proposed and putting them into a separate section, those changes say, okay, you've already set it up, and now we're getting close to the time that's expiring. Now, this new section deals with extending it at that time. And that's what this new section does, and essentially what it says is that these periods of time can be extended if notice is given to the beneficiary, and if that beneficiary has the right to say, no, I want either part or all of the money now. And the beneficiary can do that, but if the beneficiary does not do that, then the funds will stay in the custodial account, the Uniform Transfer to Minors account, for the extended period. And what these, overall, the intent here, the original statutes, as you see from the memo, the longest that funds could stay in that account for the minor were up till age 25. Now, under the new provisions, under 197, that period can be extended to whatever period, as long as the minor is given notice by the custodian, and the minor does not, in a sense, essentially, the minor is an adult. The term minor is no longer relevant because that minor is at least 18 years old. And that's the age when you can contract legally. And at that point, if the minor agrees, then the trust continues. The Uniform Transfer to Minors account continues for the extended period of time. And there can be more than one extension. So the custodian sees that, let's just take an example where the minor is immature and really not capable and recognizes that himself or herself and says, okay, let's extend it to age 30. Age 30 comes and the situation really hasn't changed. Custodian again can go back and propose that this be extended to age 35. The beneficiary who's now age 30 can compel a distribution or can essentially not compel it. If the beneficiary does not, then it will stay again till age 35. So it provides some real flexibility for these accounts.
Always subject to the right of the minor to object and to compel distribution as long as he or she does so at the moment that the extension is under consideration.
That's right. That's correct.
Further questions for Mr. Shaftel on Amendment Number 2? Further committee discussion? I'm going to remove my objection to the adoption of Amendment Number 2 and ask if there's further objection. Hearing and seeing none, Amendment Number 2 is adopted. This brings us to Amendment Number 3. I will move the objection, amendment, object to it, and turn to Mr. Shaftel.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is a provision that our group has been working on for about 3 years now, and I think Attorney Beth Chapman is there with you, who has done an awful lot of work on this provision.
Maybe we should have her come forward. She's here. Yeah, actually, that's a good idea. Why don't we do that? Ms. Chapman's here. We'll have her come forward. She's doing so right now, and we'll have her put herself on the record and have her walk us through the amendment. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Chairman French. My name is Beth Chapman. I'm an attorney. Have practiced for the last 24 years in Juneau, specializing in trusts and estates planning and litigation as well. And this amendment is a substantial revision to an current statute we have, allowing a trustee to modify or extend the term of a trust. It's going to be very similar to what you've just discussed with the custodianship accounts, where we have a situation where trust may be terminating and it's not in the best interest of the beneficiary to have the funds be distributed outright to the beneficiary. Under current law, a trustee can, in certain circumstances, extend the term of the trust and continue those assets to be held in trust for that beneficiary. Alaska was the second state to adopt such a provision following New York, and since that time, 13 states have adopted similar provisions. And it codifies a trustee's common law powers to make amendments to trust in certain circumstances. Last year, the New York legislature adopted significant revisions to their statute, and it was passed and is now enacted. And this provision follows the New York statute because it really provides additional protections for beneficiaries, provides clarity to attorneys and trustees who may be looking to use this provision to extend the term of a trust or to modify a trust to fix problems within a trust, whether it's to save tax benefits or to provide further protection for a beneficiary. The real changes that are most significant relate to notice to beneficiaries. Under the current statute, a trustee who decides to extend the term of a trust has no statutory requirement to provide certain notice to beneficiaries of that extension. I think most lawyers who have used this provision have, in fact, provided that notice. But we felt it important that beneficiaries be provided notice and the opportunity to object. The objection itself will not prevent the extension from going forward, but would give the beneficiary the option to file with the court and seek a court order with regards to the extension or other modifications. The other changes that are in here relate to when the trustee's authority is limited by a standard. For example, many trusts will say that a trustee can make distributions to a beneficiary for health, education, support, and maintenance. And that's a standard we include mostly for tax purposes, but it is a limit on a trustee's authority. Under the current law, it's unclear whether that standard could be changed and to what extent the beneficiary's interest in the trust could be limited. This provision now would provide that the trustee, when extending the term of a trust, must include the same beneficiaries, must include the the same standard for distributions unless we are, in fact, changing the trust to protect beneficiaries' rights to public assistance, because we have special needs trusts, third-party trusts, which are allowed under current Medicaid and other public assistance provisions, and we, in those circumstances, may, in fact, have to change the standard in that trust. So the real changes, I think, that are most significant are the protection for the beneficiaries. And this is a broad power granted to trustees. And it's been in the common law for many years, was codified in Alaska, I think, back in early 1990s. And now we are clarifying that law in what we spent many years, and Mr. Sheftel is correct, many years debating how far we needed to change this statute to provide those protections. And I think that this is a good model. I've spent significant amount of time, made national presentations on these provisions, and feel that the New York statute provides the most protection to the beneficiaries and yet continues to allow the trustees to modify trusts as needed without the need to obtain a court order, which, of course, increases the cost.
Sure.
And question after you.
Senator Cockhill, go ahead. I have a more global question. Go ahead.
Has there been court challenges to somebody wanting to exercise this unlimited authority?
Through the chair, Senator Cockhill. Not to my knowledge. I have used this provision multiple times, and every time I have provided notice to my beneficiaries, and in two instances where I had incapacitated beneficiaries, we have, in fact, sought court approval of the modifications, and the court has approved them.
My question is regarding the just some of the language that's used here. Maybe you can just help me understand it. Much of the amendment is couched in the terms of an appointment. You'll see on page 1, line 7, exercise of power of appointment. Page 3, line 2, additional provisions relating to exercise of power of appointment. Maybe you can just describe for me in as lay of terms as possible what that term of art means, what this appointment's about.
Senator French, a power of appointment is the authority to say who and how assets from a trust are to be received. So, for example, I could give a beneficiary a power of appointment to say that when they die, they can tell the trustee who's to receive the money when they die. So they're given the right to appoint the trust assets to somebody else. In this context, the use of the power of the appointment is that the trustee has the authority to decide how to make a distribution. So if a trustee has the unlimited authority to distribute assets to one or two people, for example, for any purpose, then they, in fact, have the power to say how that person's going to receive it. And that flows from the restatement of law for trust. And so all it means is the authority to decide who and how assets are to be received from a trust, subject, however, to the limitations on that authority that are stated in the trust.
That was probably as lay as you could make it, and it was clear to me. Thank you.
So my question still remains, is this able to survive challenges? Have there been challenges that have made this language so necessary?
Through the chair, Senator Cockhill, I am not aware of any challenges to trustee using this provision. I think that this provision will help minimize challenges, because there's now specific notice provisions, there's time limits in which you have to give the beneficiary the right to object, and it lays out the standard for objecting to the trustee's authority or exercise of the authority.
And since, Mr. Chairman, since this is not my world I operate in, my expectation is plenty of notice is given, explanation of rights and authorities are clear when people are entering into this?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, and I have to look because we revise this so often. I believe we require six. Let me think. Here. 30 days notice. which is, in my opinion, adequate. That's the generally the amount we use when we're giving notices in other trusts, such as rights of withdrawals. 30 days is a standard amount of time.
Okay. Thank you.
And let me just ask, is the, let's just say for the purposes of discussion, that your view is the majority view on this policy. Is there a minority view? Or are there trust attorneys out there who would say, oh, don't do this. This is just too far, too much, or so forth?
Senator French, I'm not aware of a minority or majority view. I think that it has been discussed in the estate planning community for years now, and each year we see additional states adopting these provisions because as we move forward and as we're seeing with custodianship accounts now, building in flexibility is a good thing because without flexibility in trust, we have to go to court, and when we go to court, the costs go up exceedingly quick. So we like to build in flexibility. I think this is an improvement over our current statute because it does provide more protection for beneficiaries and is more of a roadmap for attorneys who may not practice in this area as much as Mr. Sheftel or I do, where we would know our limitations.
Good explanation again. Thank you so much. Further questions from the committee? With that, I will withdraw my objection to Amendment Number 3. Is there further objection? Hearing and seeing none, Amendment Number 3 is adopted. That brings the bill back before us, and we've made several significant changes to the bill. With that, we'll set the bill aside. Probably, just to let members know, my expectation is that probably not Friday, but next Wednesday, I would hope to move the bill out of committee. Give it time to settle and think. So thank you. Thank you, Ms. Chapman. Thank you, Mr. Sheftel, for making yourselves available. Let me just ask, while we're here on the record for this bill, is there anybody else in the public who would like to speak on SB 165? Anyone here in the room? Hearing and seeing none, I'll close public testimony. And with that, let's turn now to the other big bill we have, which is the criminal bill, SB 186. And we will start with Senator Coghill and his amendment. We discussed his amendment last time around, but we didn't really take any sort of formal action on it. And just for my edification, there's a good summary, there's a good chart, but I guess I'm just looking at the moment for the amendment itself. Let's take a short Abby's. We're back on the record, having handed a piece of paper to the dinosaur on the committee, and the dinosaur is now ready to go forward. Senator Coghill, maybe you should move the amendment, and I'll object, and then we can just have a more formal discussion.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I'll move amendment number, I think this is number one, which is labeled under the Gardner I.1.
I.1, and I'll object, and go ahead.
I'm going to read into the record this little statement I gave you. The purpose of this amendment is to raise the threshold amounts for offenses regarding property. The offenses proposed for amendment are theft and its related offenses, which include concealment of merchandise, removal of identification marks, unlawful possession, and issuing bad check, and fraudulent use of access device. So this amendment also addresses the crimes of vehicle theft, criminal mischief, criminal simulation, misapplication of property, and defrauding, which deals with all of the misdemeanors and felonies that are going to be amended in this. So the crimes regarding properties have a value threshold that distinguishes first, second, third, and fourth degree offenses. And depending on the value of the property or the loss by the victim, a Class C felony, A or B misdemeanor. So what this does is moves those thresholds up. I prepared a chart for you that will show
the property crimes and the criminal charges. Well, I won't get to that yet. I'm sorry. I have a couple of things here. What we're doing, though, is we're taking the thresholds and moving them up for a value of $50 a Class B misdemeanor, proposing the amount to be raised to $250. For those in the second degree, increases of property $1,500 from $500 but less than $25,000. For theft in the second degree, $1,500 from $500 to $25,000 but not less than $25,000. So on we go, and you can see that the $50 threshold basically we moved up to $250, and then you'll see where we moved up to $1,500 from the $500 level. So it amends across these statutes, and the proposal is to say, is a felony really a felony? I mean, that's my fundamental question in this thing. And I told you that I think it was in the 1970s when these limits were set. So one of the questions that was asked for this amendment is, okay, what do other states do? So I handed out a graph chart that I had the staff put together, and this shows property theft felony thresholds in the western United States, showing that they can be in Alaska very low at our $500 limit, and it can be as high as the Montana, which is $1,500. So Montana, Utah fit that category for felony theft. And this proposal would put us closer in line with that, which I'm willing to have one of my staff members come in and back me up, because actually Karen Lidster, my staff, who has worked on this literally for years with me on this, has probably got more background and information. So if you want to get into more specifics, I can get that. I think we had a court document also talking about the court system and property crimes under this statute 11.46, where they couldn't get what actually was the court outcome, but they can give you what was filed as charges. And so you'll see that the theft from a value of over 500, there was 911 cases. And so you go down that the theft under 50 was 404. And so you see the impact. Fraud from 50 to 24,000 was 171. And the next biggest lot was criminal mischief and property damage from $50 to $500 was 738. So those are kind of the bulky ones that we have. Well, and theft value of $50 to $499, which had 807 cases. So that gives you kind of the feel for how this might fall out. It's been my understanding, Mr. Chairman, that there have been reasons to have the low threshold in that it holds a hammer over people, and they do quite often plead out to a misdemeanor charge. But when we look at the scale of punishments available for $100 crimes, I think the punishment actually fits better than holding a felony charge over somebody. I guess $500 would be a felony charge. That would, to me, if it was a misdemeanor at the higher level, and you had a $700 bicycle stolen or a even a $1,000 window broken, to put somebody in the felony category, to me, it just doesn't fit, especially when we look at the felonies now under personal crimes. Some of the things that would be equitable, they just don't fit. So that was the whole reason for this amendment, and it sweeps across many, many categories.
It's good good backup information chart, especially helpful. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had an interesting conversation the other day with somebody on the airplane who said that our laws actually creates some disparate treatment between urban and rural areas, because if you break a window in Anchorage, it may be a couple hundred dollars, but if you break the same Anchorage in a rural village, it could be three or four times that, which would put you from the misdemeanor into the felony category. Just a different perspective I hadn't thought of. Interesting. But I appreciate the information. And I'm just curious if there's anyone online or in the room that can tell us. So the total number of theft property crimes was 3,794. I'm trying to refresh my memory as to how many, what percentage of total crimes that constitutes.
Right, of filings in the court system. And I don't know. We have Leslie Houston on from the Department of Corrections. We have Doug Moody on from the Public Defender. And so I don't know that you'll get an exact answer to that. Either one of you witnesses want to hazard a guess on that?
This is Leslie Houston with the Department of Corrections. And could I please ask for the question to be restated?
I was just curious that it looks like the total number of property crimes in 2011 was 3,794, and I was just curious what percentage or what the total number of crimes were in the state. I'm just trying to get a sense of how big a percentage of the court system does property crimes take up.
Okay, through the chair to is it Senator Wilikowski? What I could do is have that data pulled from our ACOM system, our database, and get that back to you.
It'd be interesting to see because it's a huge number, and I'd just be curious to see how that correlates with our other numbers. See what
certainly
kind of.
Certainly, I understand it would definitely put it in perspective, so I can get that data to you.
Thanks, Ms. Houston, and I know we can look in our court annual report as well. We just don't happen to have a copy on us. But if you want to send that information to us, that'd be very helpful. We'll take a close look at it.
Further questions? I will do that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? I'll just say, looking at the chart, it looks like $1,000 is a number that many of our Western colleagues have settled on. I don't know when they last adjusted their amounts. It may be that they're equally outdated and that Montana and Utah are sort of the more modern view. I don't know. My inclination is to adopt the amendment today, and then upon further reflection and examination, we decide to adjust those numbers a little bit more. We can do that at a future hearing because, again, this is a big piece of legislation that's not leaving here today. But thank Senator Coghill for bringing this forward. I reflect on the chart that we used to kick off the crime summit that showed that in the last 20 years we've shifted from a prison population that was mostly geared towards imprisoning violent offenders to one that is now imprisoning mostly nonviolent offenders. That's expensive, and to change that requires us to make some policy changes, and this may well be one of them.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Just for what it's worth, the intention is not to lighten up on crime, but to really get the crime at whatever level it is, and property crimes probably repaying or whatever we can do within the realm of the court discretion. A year's time in jail is still a year's time in jail. That's a big deal. And probably enforcement is one of the questions I've had most often in my area is, can I get a property crime prosecuted? And getting information is tough. But I think this says to people, if property crime needs to be dealt with, not to be pled out, but the sentence is there for your use to deter that. So I hope people don't think this is to be soft on crime, but really kind of a reality check on what we're doing in our crime charging.
I think that's a good. Those are all good remarks. No one's saying that offenders aren't going to be held accountable. A year in jail is a long time. 30 days in jail is a long time. We send repeat DWI offenders to jail for 20 days on the second offense, and I think 60 days on the third offense. So we can send someone. That's a lot of prison time. Senator Wilikowski.
Before we adopt the amendment, I was curious if we could hear from the administration about their position on it.
That's a good point. I saw Ms. Carpenetti's here. She's here to describe a future amendment. Let's bring her forward. See what if any thoughts and positions the administration may have adopted with respect to this amendment. Ms. Carpenetti, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Actually, Senator Wilikowski, we don't have a position on this particular amendment. We understand the rationale, the times have changed. On the other hand, it puts us in an awkward position because we are currently charging and prosecuting people under the current law. So we don't have an objection. We understand why you're doing it, and we're certainly happy to help in drafting anything you ask us to.
Does the administration believe this is good policy?
I don't know whether anybody above me has taken a position or considered it. I think that over the years we have worked with Senator Coghill, and 30 years ago in 1978, things had a whole lot different value. But there are other considerations. Law enforcement feels a little bit differently than the prosecution, so I'm sorry to be so wishy-washy, but that's sort of the best I can do for you.
thank you. And actually, your comment on law enforcement reminds me that we do need to check in with, the police officers, the police chiefs. I don't know if you've run this amendment by them, Senator Coghill.
Not this year, but we have previously, and they have not come out big fans of this because they like to have the charge capacity, and that's totally understandable.
Good good remarks.
And to be fair, I have worked with the administration, but I have not gone up to the top policy level people to ask them for endorsement. So some of that is probably the way I've tried to make a place for this, because it was a standalone bill that I didn't think was going to get any traction this year. So in preparation for that, and I know that when you shift a threshold like this, you have the Department of Law actually charging under our present law. And so I have been cognizant of that.
Right. Tough for them to say, yep, you should raise those thresholds, and then tomorrow we'll march into court and charge someone with a felony for a $510 theft. Mm-hmm. So the amendment is in front of us. There's an objection. And let me just take a short at ease. Back on the record and just thinking about how to manage this amendment, I had mentioned hearing from the police agencies and the police chiefs. Senator Coghill has mentioned talking to some of the folks in the other body about how they might feel about this. And Senator Wilikowski, do you have some ideas?
Yeah, I think there's definitely merits to doing it. I just want to hear all sides of the story. I want to fully understand what we're getting ourselves into. I'd like to hear from law enforcement. I'd like the governor to weigh in and hear from the administration and see if they think this is good policy or bad policy, if they think this is going to lead to future crime or less crime. I just want to understand what we're getting ourselves into. A little bit of analysis.
Through the chair, I'll try and get you an answer.
Yeah, thank you.
So for the time being, Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I also agree that it's a big policy call, and whatever the administration thinks, I know that many times we've made policy calls regardless of what they think, so I still think it's a good policy call. However, I agree we should hear from all involved in looking at all sides. So with that, Mr. Chairman, at this point, not to withdraw the amendment totally, but I'll withdraw it at this time so that we can actually bring it back for the committee with some more debate.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. This just makes it easier than having it hanging while we do other business. I guess you could procedurally move on to another amendment while the objection was pending and just not vote, but it's probably cleaner to have it withdrawn. But my intention would be to address this next Wednesday. So let's try to get our witnesses queued up and alerted. The session's progressing. And, we'll just make a call. I'm very interested in this idea. I think we got to make some tough calls about who we're turning into felons if you want to focus on the real bad guys. And part of that's wrapped up in the next amendment we have. So let's go ahead and turn to that amendment, which we will style number 2.
Would you like me to stay here, Mr. Chairman?
If you would. I think you're going to be helping us. Everyone should have a copy of Amendment Number 2. It's /I, like India, dot 2. And it's offered by me. I will move it and object to it. Amendment Number 2 is before the committee. And the thrust of the amendment is to incorporate some recommendations we got from the Children's, I want to call them Children's Justice Task Force, but it's sometimes... Children's Justice Act Task Force from the joint hearing we had not too long ago. And I was really interested in the their urging us to look at ways to strengthen the statutes regarding assault on a child. It's in keeping with my desire to punish people who are violent and to... and so for that reason, the amendment's before us. And let's turn to Annie Carpinetti, who can perhaps help us understand where it fits into the statutes, what the elements are, and so forth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, I was at another hearing when the Children's Justice Task Force presented to you. So I did not hear their presentation, but I have read their materials, and I've talked to some of the people on the task force. We have concerns about their suggestions. And they are these. Prosecutors have to prove every element of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. When you add new elements that are not necessary, and then a prosecutor is presented with a choice of charging one crime where you have three elements that are similar, or another crime that has five elements, we'll always go for the crime that has three elements, because there's less chance of missing out on one particular element of the crime. And our concern with the provision in Section 1, which amends assault in the first degree, 5A, which would prohibit intentionally causing serious bodily injury to a child under 12 or a child under 16 who is mentally or physically impaired, our people in OSPA, and I called them about it because I was concerned about it, and they said that we probably would not use this particular charge because it would be easier to charge under A2, which is intent to cause serious physical injury to another. The person causes serious physical injury to any person. Now, that you also need to look at the definition proposed by the task force for serious bodily injury, which lists a series. It doesn't necessarily give you a generic definition of serious bodily injury. It gives examples of what they consider to be serious bodily injuries, and that's problematic in itself. But according to our prosecutors, all of those injuries to a child are included in serious physical injury. So that's a concern of ours in on page one. And then the second part is recklessly cause serious bodily injury to one or more on one or more occasion to a child under 12 or under 16 years of age if the child is mentally or physically impaired. That would also be covered under a crime and assault in the second degree. It's not here, but that would come over, under a crime that's already prohibited and uses definitions that we use all the time, and the courts are used to, attorneys are used to, and our courts of appeal are used to. That's a concern that we have. There are some provisions in their suggestions, and I haven't had a chance to read this memo to Doug Gardner, from Doug Gardner, but we have some. I sat down at my computer and tried to draft something that might be acceptable to you. It's really hard to do that because these statutes are pretty inclusive, and when they use bodily injury or serious bodily injury, we know what that means. And there's a possibility of considering just using bodily injury under assault one for a child, and that's something you might consider. That would be the only time we make it a Class A felony to cause just bodily injury. But these are some suggestions. I have them. I've had my boss look at them. We're not terribly enthusiastic about them, but I can make them available for you to look at. And another thing that you don't have here that I thought I might suggest is we thought about their amending the crime, which they suggest doing in criminal non-support, we would suggest, and that is failure to provide adequate food or water to a child, possibly considering amending the crime of endangering the welfare of a child in the first degree, which is a Class C felony under most circumstances, and that using terms that we are all used to or that the criminal justice system uses all the time, to recklessly fail to provide adequate food or liquids to a child that results in protracted impairment of the child's health. Those are terms that we use and that have been considered by courts before. So I'm happy to provide those for you. But we do have some concerns about these because, and the age, usually in assault and three, we talk about injury to a child under 10, under 12. We can talk about that. I don't know that we would have any serious concern about raising that age to 12 under these circumstances. But anyway, those are our concerns about the proposed amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Carpinetti. Questions for Ms. Carpinetti? I will start and just say, I got a strong impression from the Children's Justice Act Task Force that their view was that the prosecution didn't have the tools it needed to go after people that hurt children. And I wasn't 100% on board with that suggestion, having worked in the offices and knowing who works there and how strongly they feel about people who hurt kids. On the other hand, they're experts and they're working very hard in this area. So that's why I asked to have this amendment drafted. So I guess there's a little bit of a disconnect between what I heard, from their presentation, what I'm hearing from your presentation, and I'm not sure how to resolve that. But I guess I would encourage you maybe to speak to Tom Janidlo, one of their representatives, see if your conversation with him sort of yields any more information about where they feel there are weaknesses in the system. We got a task force looking at children's justice issues. They're saying we need to beef up our laws. So that's something I'm receptive to.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond to that. I have spoken to Jan Rutherdale often about these issues, and I'll have another conversation with her. And I would like to speak with Mr. Janidlo, too.
Great.
And I think Gail, I'm blanking out, another person who used to be a prosecutor and is now in the Civil Division, I will be happy to speak to them. The problem is that it's frustrating when you see injury to a child, and it's just so so maddening to see people behave that way. But the problem is sometimes you have to go to each individual situation and talk to the prosecutor because, as we have seen recently here in Juneau, you can have press about the resolution of a case that just doesn't have all the information and you can't get it all out to the people. And there are proof problems. So I will be happy to ask about specific cases particularly, and then I will, investigate the underlying reasons for the resolution that the people who were testifying thought was inadequate on the part of the criminal justice system.
Great. I mean, we shouldn't legislate by anecdote, and so that's a danger. Senator Cockhill.
I have two questions. One of them is the non-lawyer question. What is the level of proving recklessly?
Reckless is we have, as a culpable mental state, we have to prove that the person was aware of the risk and consciously disregarded it.
Okay.
As opposed to criminally negligent, that is, the person did not perceive the risk, but that lack of perception was so bad and so serious that they should be held to be criminally.
And then the other thing, Mr. Chairman, is on a person-to-person basis, in this particular charging instance where we're talking about assault in the first degree, what is the mental state issue between, say, adult on adult or adult on child that we have to specifically name a child in this issue?
Through the chair, if I understand you, Senator Coghill, the couple of mental states are the same for whoever is doing it and whoever the victim is. I mean, depending on what the statute says. So a person in, for example, under A2 of assault in the first degree with intent to cause serious physical injury, the person causes serious physical injury. And that would be the same intent, that means you intend the result, as intentionally causes serious bodily injury to a child. It's the same culpable mental state whether the victim is older or
that helps me. Thank you very much. I thought maybe we were going to where it's going to be even tougher yet to charge somebody that had done something to a child.
Oh, I don't think this does.
I didn't want to go
in,
back.
In terms of culpable mental state, right. This does not change the culpable mental state.
Further questions from Ms. Carpenetti? Thank you for being here. Let me just turn and see if either of the folks online, Leslie Houston or Doug Moody, want to weigh in on this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, this is Douglas Moody from the Public Defender Agency.
Go ahead.
Unfortunately, I don't have that proposed amendment.
Oh.
I've emailed Cindy, your assistant, Cindy Smith, but apparently I didn't realize that there were other amendments other than Senator Coghill's proposed amendment.
We will get a copy to you, and I'm likely to treat this one the way I treated Senator Coghill's, which is to withdraw it and let a little more background work get done on it before we take final action as a committee. So we'll get you a copy, Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
With that, I think we will. I will withdraw Amendment Number 2, I'll go back and do some more of my homework, Senator Coghill.
And one of the questions that I'll have, I know that we're talking about aggravators in this and the way aggravators are handled. I think, is there any way that we can take this issue of bodily injury to a child at a certain age and put it, is this going to be part of the aggravator that we end up with, or is this, was this primary charge? In my mind, I'm not 100% on this.
It's structured in the amendment as a primary charge. Is there an aggravator dealing with the youth or the age of the victim, Ms. Carpenetti?
Yes, there's an aggravator that deals with...
You probably better get a little closer to the mic. Go ahead. Sorry. Thanks.
Sorry. There's an aggravator that deals with a victim that is particularly vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that includes age. And recently the legislature amended it to include whether or not the victim was intoxicated. Mm-hmm. But age, either young or old, or various other circumstances that would make a child unable to defend her.
And Mr. Chairman, the reason the question comes to my mind is because this would create a level of proof that maybe would not necessarily have to be at the same level, if I understand correctly, on an aggravator.
Well, no, now we know that aggravators are just like charges.
But there's still more discretion, is there not?
There's a care.
Under the Blakely decision, the state would have to prove the aggravator by the same proof beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. But then in sentencing, a judge does have discretion as to weigh, what he or she thinks the aggravator is worth.
Let me ask, does your case management system let you tell me how often a certain aggravator is used?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer, but I can get the answer really quickly.
I'd be curious. That would be helpful.
I would think so, but...
Right. That'd be helpful. Right. I mean, now that you got to go to a jury on them, you'd think that you'd be tracking them more closely.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Further discussion? With that, we're going to go ahead and take a short end of the day so that some members can get their homework done. With that, we are adjourned.